Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on March 23, 2019. This is the 10th week of our Saturday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Magga-Vibhanga Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha provides a complete analysis of the Noble Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So we're at the, I think this is the eighth week or the eighth class we've had. No, ninth or tenth. but we're concluding the third or three weeks on the three different aspects of the Eightfold Path, the virtuous factors, the wisdom factors, and the concentration factors. But today's sutta is going to be on the Magga-Vibhanga Sutta, which is the Buddha's analysis of the entire Eightfold Path. And it's fitting that we use this sutta here, because this this sutta is just clear and direct instructions on how to integrate and develop the Eightfold Path, which is the only path and the whole point of the Buddha's teaching. And he reminds us in the sutta exactly why we're doing this too. It's not for escape from suffering. It's not to fix a broken self. It's not to find a superior being to intervene on our behalf. It's not to gain favor from disincarnate beings. It's a path to develop an understanding, a profound understanding of the nature of human suffering and disappointment, so as to develop an understanding so we no longer contribute to our suffering. That's an important point, because there's using the word dukkha to mean unsatisfactory or disappointing. That's just the nature of human life, isn't it? There's going to be times when ordinary events are disappointing and unsatisfying. But when we personalize them, we exacerbate the problem and create great distraction for our minds. In other words, we become literally mindless human beings whose thoughts are stuck in the past or projected in the future, and they're not here with life as life occurs. Lorna, if she wants to share about that later, gave a beautiful description of that earlier today. But again, the whole point of the Buddha's teaching is not escape. It's deep and profound immersion in human life. Quite a difference between one view and the other, isn't it? So one view, the view of fixing something that is not even real, or adding to something that is not permanent, is just foolish, isn't it? Yet most of human life and most of modern Buddhism and most modern religions are attempting to do just that, with the Buddha's teaching understanding. This is from the Magga-Vibhanga. Any questions about that? About the simple and direct purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma? Everybody understands it?
More and more.
That response brings a question in. So do you see, the Buddha's Dhamma is very specific and the path is very well focused. Do we understand the reason why it is that way? In other words, why the Buddha didn't just say, you know, if you meditate, maybe say a few prayers, maybe get a couple of gods or deities on your side. Well, again, I'm not trying to be foolish. That's a lot of what modern religion and modern Buddhism is about, isn't it? If you do these kind of things, and if you're lucky enough to get a few of these disincarnate beings to intervene on your behalf, you're good to go. But if you can't, yeah, I don't know what you're going to do.
Purgatory.
That was my great hope, because I knew that I, you know, at best I was going to avoid.
I was kind of just on that edge.
Yeah, I was going to have to do some time, hopefully not eternal time. And so Siddhartha Gautama developed a very nice way out of that way of thinking. All of that type of thinking is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And it leads to that type of speculative way of living in the world. that takes an infinite number of manifestations, but they all come back to ignorance. It's a problem of ignorance. So the Buddha's path is a path of developing wisdom where there was once ignorance. This is from the Magavabhanga Sutta. I have heard that at one time the Buddha was staying in Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anatha Pindika's monastery. There he addressed those assembled. Friends, I will now give you a detailed analysis of the Noble Eightfold Path. Listen mindfully. This is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So the choice of words is important there too, meaning right view versus wrong view, right intention versus wrong intention. It implies that there is something in the world that we could do that's wrong. I'm making this point for two reasons. One is, it's not enough to just think positive, because thinking positive is emphasizing the negative. I won't get too deep into that, but what you focus on is really what you're getting. And if you're focused on, I always need to be thinking positive thoughts to overcome all the negativity in my life, your real focus is on what's negative. And that's really what you're going to, you're not going to generate it, but you're going to notice it. It's going to be the distraction in your life.
Isn't positive thoughts really clinging?
Yes. It's a great point.
I like this.
Yeah, there's been a whole movement, by the way. There used to drive me crazy. My mother used to listen to WOR radio.
Oh, gosh.
And Dr. Carlton Fredericks, whose whole deal was the power of positive thinking. And he built he was one of the most famous radio personalities of all time. He built a pretty good living on that. Power of positive thinking. But the intention behind that is, my life is so awful that I can only think positive things to escape from that. Mm. And that whole thing is just rooted in ignorance and a fabrication, isn't it? Mm. So even if it might make you feel good, and it tends to until the walls cave in, even if it makes you feel good temporarily, that's the reason that people give it validity. But it doesn't lead to any real understanding, does it? Except that I need to always be mindful of things, seeing the positive in all things, rather than what the Buddha taught was to see the reality in all things, including the stuff we don't want to look at. Why? Because if we don't want to look at it, it's something in life. It's because we've already personalized it. And if we don't look at it, we can never recognize and abandon our ignorance. And so creating this idea that everything is wonderful and I'm only going to focus on the wonderful dismisses, discounts, and ignores the problem of ignorance. And it's a very powerful but very subtle and commonly used strategy to only look at the positive, or only look at another variant on that, very common today, and it's been common my whole life, is this idea that we're all one giant cosmic organism. In fact, the underlying philosophy while I was growing up is that as a human species, our consciousness as a whole is growing to this unity consciousness where there's all one mind and that's all that we are. Well, it's a complete fabrication, isn't it? And it completely contradicts everything the Buddha teaches. It doesn't mean that it's too bad that we lost that nice notion of unity consciousness. What is important to see is, I'm finally seeing reality here. I'm not fooling myself. I'm not fabricating myself or fabricating my existence by foolish and unfounded ideas. Anthony, I'm sorry I talked a long time after your hand went up.
That's okay. I'm struggling a little bit with what you said about positive thinking, because I often find it very comforting to try to see the positive things about people, especially people I might be in conflict with, because that allows me to understand better and have empathy and approach them more skillfully. And even just something as simple as the other day, I woke up and it was raining and I just had a negative thought and I said, yeah, but the rain can be beautiful. And I opened the window a little bit to hear the sound of it and I enjoyed it. So what's wrong with thinking positively?
I don't know that that's necessarily think what you described is necessarily thinking positively. In fact, I think you're describing something realistic. Rain is nice. But I don't have to think that way. In other words, if I happen to think, oh, it's another rainy day, that's okay too. Because if I get into, and this is where you're getting, we're getting into the subtle aspects of ignoring ignorance. Because if I feel like I can't even recognize that I don't like rainy days, I'm just further down the diluted ladder, aren't I? I'm further removed. Rather than simply acknowledging that it's in this moment, I'm not real pleased with rainy days, at least gives me the opportunity to look at that. And that, and again, your question has a lot to it, and thank you for asking it. It's important when we're interacting with people to be completely non-judgmental, but to think that this person, no matter how they're acting, I can only see the good in them, is actually denying who's standing in front of you. And when I have that, in fact, I mentioned briefly about the negotiations that I just went through. I find that insulting when I'm being manipulated that way. If somebody's constantly telling me how good I am and all my good qualities. Well, I immediately know when they're doing, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but that can easily fall into using this notion of everything is positive to manipulate reality, and that's really what happens. It's better to see things, including other people, simply as they are, without the need to positive them out of what's really going on. So. Pardon me?
I said that was a really good answer.
Well, it's an important, thank you. It's kind of obvious to there's such a subtle appeal to want to see everything positively and always see the positive or see the good in people. It sounds like such a wonderful thing to do, but it's actually denying the first noble truth, for one thing. So again, and Anthony, it's very subtle too, because just seeing people without any judgment can seem like I'm holding a positive view when it's really just a lack of judgment.
Yeah,
so better to see reality as it is than to manufacture something in my mind because I find reality so disappointing. That's the essence of ignorance. So I need to change things. I need to change the way. In fact, talking about the first part of this, I need to go from right view would teach us that just seeing the positive is a wrong view, isn't it? Because it's dismissing, and again, this isn't a matter of percentages, but it's dismissing half of life. And if we're dismissing half of life, we're dismissing all of life. So it's not seeing the positive in all things, and it's not seeing the negative, it's just seeing. This is what's occurring.
Yeah.
And when I can do, and again, it's very subtle, but when I can do that, when I can just see without discriminating it, without I like it, I don't like it, I like them, I don't like them, when I can just see, then I'm at peace. And that's the whole point. So the no matter how much I believe in making all my thoughts positive, that's just self-manipulation ultimately, isn't it? Because not everything is positive. I'm right. Playing a game that's only going to lead to constant distraction. So it's such an important point, and the levels there are so subtle that it's hard to see. I've had people accuse me of being so negative, but this is it's not. It's simply being realistic, and it frees us. The Buddha talks about a self-referential ego personality joins with their suffering. We cling to it. We identify with it. The only way to free myself, the most positive thing I can do is to let go of positive thinking.
I don't think I do it in all situations. If I have to analyze it, I think I do it in situations where I need to be present. Like, for example, if I'm driving to work and I just want to get to work, I say to myself, well, look at how beautiful things are. Like, enjoy this ride. Because it is a beautiful ride for me to go to work.
But you're not substituting, it doesn't sound like, you're not substituting one thought to overcome the negative thought of what a dreary ride it is. It's just, it's your pleasant observation of life.
Yeah.
That's integrating the Dhamma.
I think there are people that are at a point, because we have studied with you and understand what, I'm beginning now to understand what ignorance is when the way you were, the Buddha applied it and all that. But there are people, I think, out there that are in a world where positive thinking is like the best next step for them. And that's, you know,
negative.
Because they're just in such a negative place that's got to be better, you know? Mm-hmm. At least hop to the other side, you know?
Yeah. I would grudgingly agree with that because I don't ultimately I don't believe that it's truly wise to introduce any, we'll call this a system, any system that allows people to continue to ignore their own ignorance. And I can say that from, I mentioned my mom, from personal experience. She was a real true believer, and it created, and I need to finish this one class, but it created tremendous but very subtle stress in her life, because a life isn't always positive.
Yeah.
And so the things that were occurred, especially after she had a horrible last 10 years, Alzheimer's and some other difficulties, and to start falling into that with this conditioned notion that everything is wonderful just increases the suffering to such a great deal. And I remember having conversations where she was now out of frustration because she did all this positive thinking that her God is now punishing her, and she couldn't even understand that because she had no context to realize none of this is personal. She's not being punished. It's just the fact of having a human life that these things happen. So, and there's other subtle examples of that. But you bring up such a good point, Anthony, because it seems like the best thing to do is to always think everything is wonderful rather than just be present. Jen, you had your...
Yeah, so I think what the Buddha is teaching is that if you're noticing a tension within yourself, it's because you're reacting to an ordinary event like rain. You're having the rain is bouncing off of this ego. And now you're reacting to the rain. Recognize that, abandon it. So it sounds to me like you're recognizing that and abandoning it, and then you're kind of, it's giving you the space to see all the other phenomenon that are occurring that you can experience when it's raining.
Yeah, and it's also to try to temper the negative, because if there's any judgment I find that I'm exercising with somebody, it helps me to see the good in them, to balance it out, and just be to make it a real perspective.
Right.
Yes, and on a very subtle level though, there's an opportunity for understanding that is missed when you take the step from just going to seeing things positively, rather than allow yourself to view your negative view of someone, which isn't understanding that that's not based in reality. I'm thinking negatively of you, not because of you, because of my wrong views. In other words, I want you to be different somehow than you are, which forms the foundation for my negative view that I'm trying to overcome now with a positive view. Well, the negative view has already arisen within me. So I'm not really helping you by jumping to a positive view, because the most effective thing I can do is recognize the thought process that allowed me to think negatively of another human being in any way, for any reason.
Right.
And put that aside so that I think you're seeing too, in that way, in a very subtle way, positive thinking is a perfect strategy to ignore my own ignorance. I don't have to look at, so again, the negative feeling that I'm having about you is not because of you, it's because of me. And even if it's justified, you know, say I'm standing in front of the world's biggest bully, someone pops to mind, doesn't it? Even though the underlying reason for my feelings may be true, the fact that I've attached myself to a judgment of another human being is what's causing the distress in me, not the other person. My reaction to them, my harsh judgment, and my feeling.
That's what you can change.
That's what I can change.
That's what you have control over.
But if I'm hiding it, if I'm hiding my own thoughts from myself using this strategy, I'm hopeless.
But is it okay to look for the good in them to balance your view?
Well, again, I have to kind of throw the question back at you, Anthony. So excuse me for that. It's not a question of okay or not okay. In fact, this is a place where someone a little wiser than me would say, it's your question that's causing you. it isn't a question of it's okay or it's not okay. It's occurring, isn't it? And it's occurring within me. So the question I need to ask myself, is this leading to calm or is it leading to distraction and agitation?
Oh, calm for sure.
Well, not ultimately, because it's masking my underlying upset that there's something wrong with this person or there's something negative about this person.
No, I don't change. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's a subtle.
It's very subtle.
I don't change. I just accept
your intention.
Yeah. Yes, but you see, now, again, as we develop the Dhamma, we learn the profound difference between acceptance and approval. But you're, in that way, if not just you, but that idea of I need to go from I have a negative thought immediately to a positive thought is ignoring where the negative thought came from. And that's not helpful because there's no way of letting that, again, the point is that even though I'm having a negative thought about you and the negative thought might be justified in some way, it's the negative thought that is not to be ignored, but to be recognized and abandoned. And by going to a positive way of thinking constantly, when that's my conditioned response, I'm missing that point in myself. So you really could say that the strategies that we've employed as a country legislatively have been founded in this idea of positive thinking. If I could just create the scenario for positivity in the world, that justifies the actions that follow. And we do that often. And so, again, it's not a matter of is it okay or not okay. Is it best to see things only as, I mean, to me, the question answers itself. Should I only see things in a positive light?
Oh, no. I don't think you should only see things in a positive light. Well, let me give you another example. Okay, if I'm on the track and I use the run lane, there's a young woman who always steps into and walks in my run lane, and I was getting very agitated about it, and so it helped me to realize that she's not completely well, you know, that there is something, there's something developmentally wrong that I can tell with her, and that allowed me to accept and appreciate it better. So I had empathy for her. So, I mean, there, I try to like keep a balance in situations where I might feel negative and try to see the full picture. And sometimes that involves thinking in a positive way.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Anthony. We might be getting into a game of words now, semantics. Mm. But I don't see that as positive or negative. You're just seeing the reality of it. You're recognizing that this person is doing something that I might find annoying, except I understand that she's mentally ill, and that's just reality. That's not that's not positive thinking, and in fact, you could say it's not.
Right.
I mean, if somebody really wanted to get into it, would say, "Well, that's negative to see her as mentally ill." Again,
right,
it's just there's the problem
what
of
do we
positive
mean by
thinking.
Positive?
It's just simply seeing reality.
Interesting.
In fact, someone who is stuck in positive thinking wouldn't be able to accept the reality that this woman is doing this because she's. Because she's mentally ill, and so you've lost your mind over it rather than just seeing it. Great discussion. Let me get back to this.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's such an important discussion.
I like want to high five you now.
Exactly.
This is the noble, and again, I'm going to read this again. The point of going back to this is just to describe the verbiage used. Right view implies wrong view. I could just as easily use the word skillful or unskillful or appropriate or inappropriate. But right versus wrong gets right to the heart of the matter. It's not in a moral sense or strictly a moral sense. It just shows that the Buddha's teaching that there is a right way to live in the world, a right way to engage in his Dhamma, and many, many wrong ways. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. And the Buddha teaches exactly what those are. And it's very simple and direct. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress. Notice how this relates to the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. Knowledge with regards to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regards to the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. So notice what the Buddha didn't say here. And what is right view? Right view is seeing everything positively. But again, it makes the point, doesn't it? There's a significant difference between positive view and right view. And I'm certainly not trying to put you down. You made one of the most important classes. You contributed to that in a long time because of this subtle difference. It's so important. I've been trying to teach this in context for a long time, but it's so hard to get at it. Again, I'm thanking you for those questions, because it gets right to the heart of the matter, doesn't it? And what is right view? Knowledge with regards to stress. And I don't want anything, if I'm a Dhamma practitioner, I don't want anything to distract me from that. An awakened human being told me this is what I'm doing here. Okay. The Buddha concludes that by saying, this, friends, is right view. So right view is an overarching and complete understanding of Four Noble Truths. That's why the Buddha taught those Four Noble Truths, because they are the truth of existence. And what is right intention? Being mindful of the intention to recognize and abandon wrong views. And then a little bit more subtle way, right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. Specifically, craving for and clinging to wrong views or ignorance. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon wrong views. Being mindful of the intention to remain free from ill will. This is right intention, right? Being mindful of the intention to remain harmless to all beings. Does anybody feel they can't maintain right intention? Simple and direct, isn't it? This, friends, is right intention. And what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from abusive speech, abstaining from gossip, and abstaining from idle chatter. Does anybody feel they can't do that? Does anybody feel they can't do that 100% of the time?
That's very difficult.
Hence Dhamma practice. And what is right action? Abstaining from taking life, abstaining from taking what is not freely given, abstaining from sexual misconduct. This, friends, is right action. Does anybody feel they can't do that?
Can I just...
My wife always makes me kill spiders, so I can't do it.
Can I just interrupt a minute, going back to what Anthony was saying? I mean, the point that he doesn't like the rain, or he woke up this morning and thought, it's raining. I mean, isn't that eye making right there? That you connect with the eye.
Yeah.
To say, it's raining this morning. This lady's in the wrong lane. She's in my lane.
That's to be at peace with all
with
things that occur.
Making,
yeah.
That you've got to connect with for you to see you're right or you're wrong.
Yes. And that's why it's so important to recognize these things, even these subtle forms of positive thinking, or another way of saying it might be of passing the buck.
Mm.
But it's internal passing the buck. It's passing the buck from this one thought that I don't want to another thought that they're still my thoughts.
Still
so you can't escape it.
All stress is some form of personalization.
It is, everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is what your questions in this class has brought up, that very subtle aspect of eye making now forget about the negative and positive argument, by seeing anything different than it is currently is eye making, because the motivation always has to be me wanting something to be different than it is. Mm. Whether it's me wanting to see you differently than you are. I mean, the negative person that you're feeling negative about might be a negative person. Mm. Let them be. You know, they don't have to be. I don't have to conjure up a different image in order to feel good about myself. In fact, it's really my underlying harsh judgment that's motivating me to see something in a way that's not based in reality. A great class. And what is right livelihood? Right livelihood abandons dishonest livelihood. Right livelihood is honest livelihood. And it also incorporates right speech and right action. This, friends, is right livelihood. And what is right effort? Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to avoid unskillful qualities that are not present. It's a lot of words to say that we are now beginning to practice restraint at the sixth sense base. And we know the Buddha just described what virtuous behavior is, so now we know what to guard against. Guard against unvirtuous behavior. And again, the progression is even quite brilliant here, isn't it? Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to abandon unskillful qualities that are present. So it simply means to use the Eightfold Path as intended, use the framework of a developing measure of concentration and the right mindfulness to hold in mind the virtuous aspects of the Eightfold Path, and so that we can lead to abandoning unskillful qualities that are present, including the compulsion to see things all positively or all one way within any type of conditioned view that I might have developed in my life. Right effort is effort developing the desire and ongoing persistence to establish skillful qualities that are not yet present. What would be those qualities? Concentration, mindfulness, the skills that are associated with the Eightfold Path. Understanding the nature of suffering is a skill that's developed through the Eightfold Path, and abandoning that unvirtuous behavior. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to end confusion and increase the full development of skillful qualities that are present. The Buddha taught just as much to recognize and abandon what is no longer present and to recognize and abandon what is present. And when we recognize what is present, did I just say recognize and abandon? Recognize and develop skillful qualities that are present, such as right view, right intention, right speech, etc. Those are the skillful qualities that we develop. There's nothing ambiguous. This, friends, is right effort. And what is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the body, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. It relates directly to the Satipatthana Sutta too. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of feelings arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. Again, that abandoning greed and reaction. Greed is wanting anything to be different than it is, wanting more of something, less of something, etc. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the mental qualities arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. That relates directly to what we were talking about with Anthony. Abandoning greed in reaction to worldly events is abandoning the greed that would drive me to say that I need to look at someone differently than I am, rather than simply be at peace with what it is. And then the question might be, well, what if the way you're thinking about someone leads to hurtful behavior? That's the whole point, to recognize your behavior. This isn't a method of justifying or excusing poor behavior. In fact, it's a way of finally recognizing all unskillful behavior and abandoning it, which is possible, by the way, as human beings.
I was going to say paralyzing.
Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the quality of mind arising and passing away free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed in reaction to worldly events. This, friends, is right mindfulness. And what is right meditation? For one who has developed right meditation, Their concentration increases and they withdraw from the need for sensual stimulation. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they withdraw from unskillful mental qualities. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they enter and remain in the first jhana, the first level of meditative absorption, which is joyful engagement and pleasure in the Dhamma, born from withdrawal and accompanied by directed thought and mindful evaluation. The first jhana, a lot of words again. It simply describes what each and every one of us does when we begin meditation. And that initial connection with the breath and the initial recognition, even if it's just in that one moment of connecting to the breath, of the seclusion. That I've established seclusion and I appreciate that seclusion. That's the first jhana. And every one of us has experienced that, right? Correct? Yeah. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and their direct thoughts and mindful evaluation quiets. They enter remain in the second jhana, or the second level of meditative absorption, which is joyful engagement and pleasure born of deepening concentration, free from directed thought and mindful evaluation, and confident within. That's that second level of meditative absorption. We all experience it too. We find recognition in the seclusion and pleasure in that recognition in the first jhana. And as we stay mindful of our breath, coming back to it again and again, our minds quiet ever deeper. And even if it's just for a moment, directed thought falls away. And possibly just for a moment, but that's the second jhana. And we've all experienced that, correct? And we've all experienced this feeling of a developing inner confidence or inner poise, right? And it's important to recognize that as a direct result of meditation. That's why the Buddha teaches these ever-deepening levels, Lorna.
But when you're on your cushion and you're meditating, it's not so much directed thought falls away. It's a wandering thought. It's just like a thought. So what's that thought as opposed to a directed thought? Because eventually when you sit for 2 minutes, you stop, thoughts are still racing through. Mm-hmm. You know, 15 minutes, it's quiet, 30 minutes, you know. Well, your meditation goes up and down a bit, but... So, when your mind is like, not a directed thought, but a wandering thought.
You once described your meditation practice as your thoughts are here and your breath is here, meaning that your thoughts are flowing without being distracting. Mm. That's undirected thinking.
All right.
Directed thinking is simply thinking that has our attention, that we're directing.
Right.
And so it could be that we're not, in fact, meditation helps us learn this, that we don't even realize that we're caught up in our thoughts. That's the instruction. Yeah. Notice that you're caught up in your thinking again. The fact that you needed to notice it is not directed thought. The directed thought is the thinking that is distracting you from your breath,
right,
or from what's occurring. So I guess the nomenclature can be a little bit confusing, because it's a self-directed thought. It probably is a better way of describing it, even though we're not in control of it at that point, as opposed to the Vitakka Santana Sutta. And do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
So another important question, because it could be confusing. So any time that we're not in control of our thoughts, it's a directed thought. It's directed by a lack of understanding. Mm-hmm. Good question.
But even if we're... we always will have thoughts flowing.
Always.
Okay.
Yeah. I know I used to say... The only way that we can actually quiet our thinking is to cut our heads off, and I do not recommend it.
Never recommend it.
That's not that funny. That's probably why I don't say it.
I'm not going to try
that. But again, it's another misunderstanding that meditation is about finding a blank slate or developing a trance-like state. Nothing is further from the truth. It's simply not to be distracted by your thoughts, which implies that, yeah, there's got to be thoughts. but we're not distracted. Our thoughts are down here and our breath is up here.
Okay. And that's the concentration.
Yeah. Much like we don't have to think about each heartbeat, and yet our heart keeps beating. And the same thing with thoughts. It's the nature of a mind and a body to process thoughts. It's not skillful to be distracted by those thoughts any more than it would be skillful to think about each heartbeat. There's now that, you know, you can't take metaphors too far to lose. At some point, we need to be in control of our thinking and think appropriate thoughts when it's appropriate to think those thoughts. There's the Vitakasanthana Sutta again. The Buddha teaches that we finally gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, meaning when it's appropriate. Our thinking will reflect what's occurring here in a realistic way. And it, again, even goes back to that question of positive thinking.
Excellent.
There's a lot here, isn't it?
Yeah.
For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and their joyful engagement fades. Equanimity arises with mindfulness of pleasure in a mind united with the body. Mindfulness of pleasure with the mind. And it, all that it's teaching us is now we're deepening our concentration, we're in the third jhana. The joy of this feeling has fallen away, and we're simply in this pleasant abiding of equanimity. Being a third jhana, it's not yet well established. The wise know this, referring to they enter the third jhana. The wise know this as equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. It's one of the most significant things any human being can accomplish, which is develop a third level of meditative absorption, a third jhana, but all that it is a pleasant abiding. What's the point there? Well, the point is that, for one, is that it's not impossible to achieve a pleasant abiding, and there's no reason to personalize the experience, such as, wow, I'm such a wonderful person. I can now pleasantly abide. It's just a pleasant abiding. It's what we do.
Awesome.
We're developing a direct experience of what we truly are. And what we truly are is not, again, I don't want to beat the dead horse because this is important. What we are is not positive or negative or even any variation between the two. What we are is a mind united with its body that understands the three marks of existence and the ever-changing nature of satisfactory experiences. They come and go. And yet, because I've established it in my mind, I can take this pleasant abiding off my cushion and into my life. And that relates to the next level.
I've had that even in the most unusual places, like in New York City, or like last weekend I went to the Little York for St. Patrick's Day for a drink and an appetizer, and there was chaos all around me, and I just felt so calm and quiet, and I noted that. I said, this really feels good, and I think it connects to the meditation.
Absolutely, and it's important that you recognize that.
I just enjoyed everybody being engaged by the band playing and having a good time, and I just sat and watched it, and I was like, wow, I feel so comfortable. Normally, I'd be a little nervous in a crowded bar alone.
So you had an experience, a profound experience of having your mind united in its body. And the setting wasn't anything extraordinary, yet it became extraordinary to you because you were present for it.
Yeah.
It was significant because of that. That's really the point. And so then our life, excuse me, our moment-by-moment life becomes completely meaningful, everything that happens. So when we are in that quality of mind, there's no reason to be grasping for more because we are finally satisfied. And we're satisfied not because of what we have, we're satisfied because of what we know.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, I know. That's what the Buddha is teaching. He's teaching us to know what's going on. What is it? What does it really mean to have a human life in an environment that's ever changing and is prone to disappointment unless we understand what's going on. Next week we're going to start looking at the three marks of existence, and I'm sure it's one chapter in the book. We're going to take 2 or 3 weeks to look at those three marks too, and two new suttas. One that's part of the book, the Sambodhi Sutta, and it gets into very subtle aspects. The second sutta that I'll be doing in 2 weeks gets into these very subtle aspects of eye making, and it's fascinating how the Buddha describes it again 2,600 years ago. In such a clear and direct way. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases. Their mind rests in equanimity. Neither pleasure nor pain have a footing. Neither pleasure nor pain. That's a difficult understanding for a self-referential ego personality to even want to aspire to. Mm-hmm. Because a self-referential ego self lives in pleasure and pain. It's established itself, as the Buddha would say, it's joined with its suffering. So it might seem like a good idea to get rid of pain, but I don't want to get rid of pleasure. Mm-hmm. Including the pleasure of and the compulsion to judge people in a certain way. That's a very subtle, but very damaging and very difficult thing to let go of. And one of the reasons why I say to always be gentle with ourselves, is that ultimately, if we're going to let go of harsh judgments of others, we have to start with ourselves. We cannot be harsh on ourselves and be gentle with others. It just doesn't work. We can put on the appearance of that at times. Mm-hmm. But if we truly love other people and love humanity, we'll awaken. So that type of behavior is no longer present in us, not in other people. Now again, it's something so radically different what the Buddha taught then and today. If we really want to change, if we want to live at peace in the world, we have to generate it in our own minds. Another way of saying that is if we want to live conflict-free in the world, we have to be conflict-free. How do we understand the nature of conflict? The brilliance of the Buddha's Dhamma is that we recognize the conflict in our mind through the virtuous aspects of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. But we're able to do that through a ever-deepening concentration, and then the refined mindfulness that's informed by right view. In other words, right view initially informs us what to look for. And then ultimately, right view is simply an establishment in equanimity. Neither pleasure nor pain have a footing. They enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Their mindfulness and equanimity is pure, free of wrong views, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This, monks, friends, is right meditation. This is what the Buddha declared. Those gathered were gratified and delighted at his words. That's the end of the sutta. Remarkable sutta, isn't it? And it's such complete and direct guidance for how to develop the Eightfold Path, isn't it? And so again, the reason why I read it again is to just remind you that when you're a little bit unsure of where you are in the path, read this, and it'll show you just what you need to do and what you don't need to do. You know, it's really a very powerful way of remaining focused on what we need to do and abandoning what we don't need to do, which is simply more distraction. So let's go around the room. We'll start with Mary. Hold on, let me unmute you a little bit here. Hi, Mary.
Hi, John. Can you hear me?
I can. How are you?
I'm very good. This is really great because whenever we get into the subtleties, we can sort of self-monitor and recognize where sometimes we think we're on the path and, gaining progression. And it's these little subtleties of self-check where you might be just at a certain stage of your meditation, but it doesn't necessarily mean there isn't more work to be done. You know, like little moments of like regression, like any other kind of, whether it's childhood development or other kinds of emotional or psychological development, you have, it's possible to have moments of regression before you have progression again. And these little subtleties that we're discussing today kind of shed a light on that, you know, for each of us to continue to look inward, not outward, not at others, but ourselves, when these regressions happen, be gentle with ourselves and get back on the path.
Yep, that's it.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you. It's wonderful.
And good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Please say hello to David.
I will.
Nick, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm good.
Well, actually, I have a cold. That's why I didn't come to class today. The first quarter is affect everybody.
Well, I hope you feel better soon. But yeah, thanks. Thanks for not coming. How was your class this morning?
John says hello.
Hello. I'm listening, and I know where I am now. Where I am now is I have, I'm reaching a point where I'm accepting all these negative thoughts that I have. You know, we're not supposed to use the word negative or positive, since the best way I can describe it. It's being haunted by my mistakes, and I'm learning to accept them. I'm learning to come back to a center, and but it would be nice to have a positive point once in a while. I'm certainly not there yet, and that's the balance I'm looking for.
Yeah, Nick, it's so important that you're recognizing, we talked a little bit the other night too, that you're recognizing the ever-deepening level of concentration and how that's contributing to a more peaceful quality of mind.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, again, it's so important to recognize it, and it's just beginning for you. So I'm glad you joined us this morning. You too, Mary. Let's go around the room. Eva, good to see you.
John, it's great to be here. Great to be with everyone. All I can say is, well, what Mary said was kind of one of the things I was thinking, but also just that it's so simple, and yet the more involved I get into it, which I am deeply, it just seems so complicated. It is peeling onion layers, and I think, oh, wow, now I've got it finally. And then it's like, no, wait. There's still more, you know? and it's a very subtle process of just becoming aware, and it does give an enjoyment of the world that is a new experience that's very gratifying. So I thank you.
Yeah, what an important point. There's a subtle. I don't want to use any charged words. There's a subtle and profound aspect of life that's not available unless we're available to live it. It's just that way. And that really is, you know, and this is not something I thought much about until I realized it, how sad it is, just to use the word, that most of us as human beings just miss the point of being here. Because we're so caught up on getting and avoiding that we simply don't live. And that's a good example of it. And noticing it is so important. Thank you. Lauren, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. What you spoke about earlier, I was talking to John earlier that in a meditation, actually it was yesterday morning, I really got a quiet mind, and really for the first time I could see each breath as an individual breath. it wasn't a succession of breathing. I could focus on just where I was in that breath at that time, to the point that there was nothing on this side, there was no history, or there was no past tense, and there was no next breath, there was no future tense in my mind. There was just what was happening right at that point of time, and that's all that was in my mind. And I haven't really had that experience on the cushion quite like that before. And that was it. I got very excited.
You should. Thank you for sharing that.
That's everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say that that's an appropriate excitement too.
Mm.
As long as you don't lose your mind over it. But that you're describing the fourth jhana too.
Mm.
That it's, there's no.
But there's a lot of concentration there.
Yeah.
It was absolute concentration. It wasn't something I drifted into.
But it wasn't forced. I mean, to get back to that, it wasn't directed. It was something that developed from your concerted right effort.
Yes.
Or continued right effort.
That's
or
correct.
Concerted
yeah.
Effort.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. And that's how. And nobody, you know, nobody can impose that on you or instill it in you. You have to develop that yourself. There's no belief in that. You know, there's no faith.
No.
There's only the direct experience.
It
and if you didn't
is.
Have
yeah.
The experiences of the past couple years, you wouldn't recognize this experience.
No.
Again, that's what the Buddha point. It's so important to recognize this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Jen.
Hi. I feel like I said enough today, so happy to be here. It was a good class, and thank you.
Glad you're here.
Can I just say, maybe... Was it this sutta that you referred to Jen's comment about that you need lineage?
Impermanence
needs
yeah. requires
near
time.
Near time. I've been thinking about that a lot.
I don't think
yeah,
this
I
this
have.
One,
and I think that helped me get to that place
yeah.
on my meditation cushion, because I've read this a few times, and you thank Jen in your writing, and I do think that had an influence on my mind. On the cushion. So thank you, Jen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
Yes, what was that?
What was it?
remember on retreat, I don't remember which was the last retreat you were on, but was it last spring or anyway?
Spring, yeah.
We had a great discussion on, I don't think it was through this sutta. I can't remember.
No,
which
it, was
one.
It was the first sutta that you read when we, it was the first, and I can't, Nagara Sutta?
Nagara
is that
Sutta?
The one where you,
with Buddha describes his awakening?
His awakening, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
And Jen said that ignorance requires time.
You have
and
to,
it's such
well,
a profound...
Our minds perceive time linearly. That is that's a construct of your mind that time is linear. Time really isn't linear. But because we perceive things on a timeline, it causes stress. Because... It's me now, it's me before, it's me in the future. And if you can recognize that and just let go of that linear timeline, there's nothing, you know, there's way less to stress out about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not worried about what's going to happen, and you're not thinking about what you did wrong or whatever.
Yeah.
And a mind that is rooted in ignorance requires a past future, a constant past future self-reference. That's how it establishes itself. And again, so the profound understanding that Jen is talking about here is that when you let go of all views in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, you, and again, this is the Buddha's teaching on the deathless state. The Buddha describes living in ignorance as living a life of death. That's what the Buddha's reference to being dead. It's not being physically dead. It's living a life without the opportunity to have a life because of ignorance.
I think on a practical level, and like what Lorna's talking about, is it's helpful to see that so that when you are thinking about the past, and you say this in your writing too, in the book, if you're thinking about the past or the future, that you're already making. It's just like a way to really quickly kind of identify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always. I mean, again, people will take that too far. Putting the mortgage check in the mail before the 15th
right.
of the month
right.
is not eye making. It's just a practical way of living in the world.
Yeah.
You know, putting on a pair of shoes before you go out in the snow is not eye making. It's just practical.
Right. But if you're actually writing that check, and you're thinking about how I have to do it and own it, and that's on something else on my list.
Yeah.
That's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
eye making.
Yeah.
Because if you're thinking about it when you're not actually writing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just
and,
right.
And you can have an innumerable number of thoughts associated
right.
with that. Like,
oh,
you know, yeah, I mean, yeah, pick one.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do I have to pay a mortgage? Or look how wonderful I am. I can afford this mortgage. You know? Or just to do it.
But that's not imagining yourself in another realm when you're thinking about, I need to go home and write a check. That's not, it's just...
That's the proper use of the mind.
Yeah, I would say that's practical thinking.
Yeah, but if it's, when I get home, I'm going to write a check, how stupid am I for not doing it so far?
Oh,
that's
the jam
the
I'm
going to
get into, and now I have to remember this, and then...
Yeah, it's just
the... Yeah, so the human thought process is meant to be used the way it's designed, but not to distract us from the past into the past or into the future, and not create false views of self.
And this is all a human construct, so we gotta
yes.
play their game.
And so what are we really talking about right now? We're talking about the difference between wrong view and right view.
Mm-hmm.
The essence of the Buddha's Dhamma. But it's lost when we start adapting, accommodating, or embellishing or substituting at all. This is it. It begins and ends with right view. Beginning right view is that I don't understand it all. Something's missing in my understanding in the world. I'm disappointed, I'm distracted, I'm agitated. I'm always arguing. Whatever it might be that gets us to start looking towards something different is the beginning of right view. And then we realize that the problem with my view is that it was ignorant of Four Noble Truths. So as the Buddha starts his teaching here, developing understanding is developing understanding of four truths. It's liberation. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Well, I don't have anything further to add except that this was a wonderful meeting. I also wanted to remind you, and maybe we covered it, but you said you wanted Lorna to share something.
Oh, that was it.
That was it. Okay.
You're missing
yeah.
Well, no, I knew you shared something, but I wasn't sure that was exactly what you mentioned
yes,
in the beginning.
Yeah. It is. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you for all of you for what inspired a great class. Becky, good to see you.
Thank you. Really good to be here. I don't really have too much to add except that it's so helpful,
yeah.
Especially when you're dealing with something that's very difficult to deal with, and there's an opportunity to do an extreme amount of eye making. Because it, you know, it kind of feels good. This helped me so much to continue with the process that I'm going through and be more mindful and skillful of how I relate to the other people who are going through it as well. So this class came at an extremely fortuitous moment for me, and I just thank you very much. It was great.
Thank you, Becky. That you kind of rehashed the Buddha's words here. Mm-hmm. Right effort is the effort to avoid unskillful qualities that have yet arisen. That's just what you're talking about. That's integrated right effort. And we can do that. The point I'm making is that we can have that kind of control over our lives rather than just reacting to things and even sitting in reaction, meaning I know there's a situation coming up and I know this is what I can expect and this is what people are going to be doing. And we just build ourselves up into this little
right.
molten volcano of
yeah,
of frustration and anger. And all of it is occurring here. None of it is real. Even if it's likely to happen, it's still not real. And yet, look at what we put ourselves through. And it's all because of our thinking is rooted in ignorance. And it's remarkable.
Thank you.
No announcement I talked about earlier. The retreat is on May 16th to May 19th. Please come. okay, we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So next week you'll read the chapter on the three marks of existence. I think that's what is coming up next. Anyway, it better be because I'm already planning on. And I'll link it in the email. But in the book, there's most of the Sambodhi Sutta, which will be the one we're reviewing next week. I'm rewriting it and adding a little bit to it. And again, that'll be linked in the email. And then next Saturday, two weeks from then, will be a new sutta. And we'll conclude, I think, 3 weeks from 3 weeks from today on the three marks of existence. We're going to stretch it out a little bit and look at it a little bit deeper for a few reasons. It's been the it's interesting to me that the most hits that I get through a search engine is on the three marks of existence, which tells me a lot. For one thing, that's not really mentioned much in modern Buddhism, so people are realizing the importance of understanding that if they're seeking it out. And it just got me thinking, I want to spend a little bit more time so I can put a little bit more emphasis on that on the website too. So we're gonna do that here. Starting next week. But read the chapter and read the Sambodhi Sutta. We'll finish with metta as we always do. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning.
John, peace. Thank you very much. It's been great.
Thank you all. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.